Welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast, where business leaders come to share their advice and journeys to success with existing and emerging leaders of America. Join us as we delve into the minds of these accomplished individuals, uncovering the strategies and insights that have propelled them to the top. Whether you're an established leader or an emerging force in the business world, this podcast is your go-to source for the knowledge and inspiration needed to navigate the dynamic landscape of American business. Now, here's your host, Dylan Bloyd.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast. Today's guest is Chris Dyer. Chris is a company culture and remote work expert. He is a number one leadership speaker on culture from Inc. magazine, best-selling author of two books, The Power of Company Culture, Remote Work, and just released a second edition of The Power of Company Culture on October 31st. Chris has been named number 5 on the Leadership Power List, a top 50 voice in leadership, top 40 change management guru, top 50 global thought leader, and a top 101 global employee engagement and experience influencer by Inspiring Workplaces and WorkBuzz, and that is just from this year. Chris, that tired me out just reading it, and I can only imagine the amount of work that went into it for you to receive those accolades. So congratulations, and thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
All right, so if you could please give us a brief background on yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I mean, you gave me a great introduction there. I think maybe the only thing that's missing from context is, I ran a successful company for 20 plus years. I sold at the end of 2021. I've had lots of other ventures and things that I've been involved in. So I am an entrepreneur at heart. Having companies, having employees, independent contractors, all that kind of thing has been normal for me for, 25 years or so. And out of that, I was able to learn a lot of lessons and apply a lot of really great ways to ensure that the company was productive, had high performance, had high profits, but also was a place that our people really wanted to work, where we saw them thriving, wanting to stay, enjoying their jobs, really being a part of the company in a real meaningful way, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was those lessons, it was the things that we applied, that we did, that I just thought was normal, mm-hmm. that I just thought was good business, turned out was abnormal, right? And so people would ask me to come and speak about it. They asked me to write books about it. And I just feel really lucky and fortunate that, I'm able to share that with people. I'm able to tell them the things that we figured out, that it turns out a lot of other successful companies figured out as well. It's just that most people do it pretty terribly. Most business owners are pretty bad managers and most workplaces suck. And that's the really sad reality. And so I just want to try to help companies one culture at a time get a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. What are some of those businesses that you did start?
So my main business that I sold, the biggest, most successful, was called People G2. We were a background check company, drug testing. So when you hired somebody, we would check them out, make sure they were telling the truth on their resume and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. I saw that it was one of the best places to work in the U.S. and one of the fastest growing companies as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, we got that 5 times. So I was really proud of that.
5 times. That is unheard of. You speak a lot about remote work. So in 2020, obviously, remote work became the new norm for a little while, at least. And now, at least from my perception, if businesses are going towards more of a hybrid approach or really just trying to bring people back to work, why do you promote remote work? What are some misconceptions of remote work and how can companies utilize it more effectively?
Sure. So what we really saw with the pandemic was a democratization of flexible work. What I mean by that is that bosses and managers and people, salespeople, they were on the road all the time anyways. Mm-hmm. They were already doing hybrid work. This is not new. Right. They just got a lot better tools to help them do it because of the pandemic, but like they were already doing it. So many of my clients would be like, we need to meet next week. Well, I'm in Dallas on Thursday. I'm in Albuquerque on Friday. Like they were all over the place anyways, right? Just normal. But we allow the average employee this opportunity to be able to say, it's better for me to work from home today. Or maybe this week I could work from home. I have this big project and I need peace and quiet. Like I need mm-hmm. to be away from the office, right? So for most companies where they need some mix of that. The hybrid thing is going to work for them. And they were already doing it. They're just allowing more people to do it, which okay. I think is a really important factor. Businesses don't realize how many hours they lose in productivity, how much it costs them when people take an entire day off because they got to take their kid to the doctor for an hour, mm-hmm. right? And, or they want to go volunteer at their kid's classroom, or maybe they have a sick parent and they've got to take them to an appointment. Instead of them just saying, I'm working from home today, I'm going to pop out, go to that appointment, come back, keep working, mm-hmm. get my stuff done. It's a much better solution for employees or employers. Now, as you talk about remote work, that's a whole separate thing. Being fully remote, I think, has incredible advantages for companies that can do it. Not right. everyone can do it. But for those that can, it is a fantastic way to grow and scale a company. It allowed me to hire people all around the country. You know, I could hire someone where the cost of living was half of what it was in where I live. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting the same great person who's got a great degree, great experience, and they're coming in at half the price mm-hmm. or a quarter less, right? And so suddenly I can hire a better person, or I can hire two people when I could only afford one before, right? So it allows companies that are trying to be scrappy, that are trying to compete with the big boys, to really leverage, I think, a superpower, especially when the big giant companies are saying, oh no, we got to have everyone back in these offices because we paid for these expensive buildings. Mm-hmm. The last thing I would say is probably you shouldn't listen to all of the hype in the news. There are big companies that are coming back, that are bringing their people back, but there is more remote and hybrid work now than there ever has been. And there is continuing to be pushback, strikes, people leaving their jobs when we are making them come back for no good reason, mm-hmm. right? And so this is going to continue to be an upward trend, and it needs to be something that people really think about leveraging and understanding and getting better at if they want their companies to thrive.
Yeah, you're right. With all the easy ways to have meetings now through Zoom, like how we're having a conversation right now, what's the point of having them come in? Because that's a lot of the things that I think that I see is they'll be like, you need to come in for your weekly meeting, or, you know, weekly touch base, or whatever the case may be, or you need to do 2 days in the office, 2 days outside of the office. But like you said, for what? You know, why wouldn't you want to keep them remote, especially if somebody mm-hmm. can be half the price working from a different state? So when you're consulting with these businesses, how do you tailor your strategies to different types of organizations or industries?
Well, I mean, listen, there is a certain amount of customization that has to happen. We have to really understand the business at a very deep level to be able to provide the right advice or the right strategy. There's like a Venn diagram, right? Of like, what is it that is important to them? What is the thing that we're trying? What is the purpose of why they brought me in that we're trying to solve for them? Then there is the expertise factor. What is it that I have done? What is it that I do? What is it that I'm good at that can help them with that particular issue that they've identified, right? So we have the issue, we have the purpose, the reason we're there. We have my expertise. Mm-hmm. And inside of that expertise circle is there is an incredible amount of studies and data and things that I've studied and done that says the answer to your problems is pretty typically these seven things that I've laid out in my the two versions of my book, The Power of Company Culture. There's these seven pillars, right? And typically, if you want to get better at company culture, better at engagement, better at performance, productivity, and profits, you better make sure you're good at all seven of these things, because usually companies are struggling at least one, usually three or four, if they're mm-hmm. calling me. They're struggling in a few areas. And then the last area is, how do you actually get it done? It's like, how do I be the whatever I got to be for them? Am I being the cheerleader? Am I being the clown? Am I being, you know, the I don't know, the knight in shining armor? Like, they need somebody to come in and inject a certain amount of enthusiasm and fresh perspectives and ideas. But again, we have to, all three things have to work. I think mm-hmm. sometimes companies get disenfranchised or kind of not that happy with consultants because they're not able to solve all three issues, right? maybe they have the expertise and maybe they can really get people to do things, but they're not the right person to really drive the change on the actual problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I always make sure I can do all three before I ever work with a company, so that we can actually change, we can actually create real results, we can actually notice, feel, and even measure that we've done something that matters.
Right. So when you go into those companies, you have a pretty good feel of what their current culture already is. Have you just been doing this for a long time? You just kind of go in there and you kind of have a general understanding, or does it take a little while?
It depends on the company. So if, you know, a big company brings me in, it's going to be really hard to like just walk in and go, well, I know what the culture is. Because honestly, floor four culture, and you go on the elevator, you go to floor five, and all of a sudden it feels totally different. Same company, it'll feel very different. You go to one office versus another. So there are a lot of subcultures, especially in larger organizations. So sometimes what we have to do is spend a lot more time in data. We've got to collect more survey data. We've got to talk to more people and really figure it out. But if I'm walking into one office,
Yeah,
I could pick it up pretty quickly, you know, of what, at least what people are feeling. Mm-hmm. I may not know where the problem lies yet, but like I can sense what people are feeling.
Right.
You know, they feel scared. Do they feel like, you know, it's just, you better watch your back. Mm-hmm. You know, is that kind of culture? I mean, you could pick that stuff up pretty quickly when it's in one building or one place. But yeah, that's really important that we figure out what that is and, you know, what's really going on if we want to address what the problem is. And to be very clear, what's working? I don't know if anyone's ever worked in a job and you got a new boss and like things were pretty good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could get a little better, but they were pretty good. And that boss comes in, it's like, we're going to change everything.
Right.
Yeah. Because this is how I do it. And I want to put my stamp on it. And you're like, we're like right at our goal. Like we're doing really good. Like,
yeah.
And they're like, I don't care what's working. We're going to change it all. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that's the stupidest thing you can do. Like the first thing I want is, what do we do well? What's working? Because I don't want to screw that up. Mm-hmm. I want to help us get better at where we're struggling.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And usually you'll get a ton of pushback from that as well, right? When you come in, try and make tons of changes, and especially for the people who have been there for a long time and they're saying, you know, this is how we've always done it. I'm not changing my ways. Obviously, you're going to get those in every company. But, you know, if you go in and say, like you just mentioned, go in there and say, we're going to change everything. It doesn't matter what works. That's usually when you get a lot of pushback, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Making changes in business for the short term is easy, right? Implementing changes. How do you go about making changes for the long term and putting those things into place? What do you do differently and what are your strategies to make it so it's effective in the long term?
How long is this podcast? We got a few days to talk. I mean, this is a big question, but right. let's maybe narrow in on a couple like easy things.
Okay.
The first is I like to call them the flip-flown crowd. And this is an old term. People may not all know what that means, but back in the day when we first got smartphones, before that we had flip phones.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole group of people that did not want to give up their flip phones. They were like, I'm not going to the dark master of Apple. I will not do this. And they held on to these little flip phones until they broke, until the buttons fell off, until like they could, there was no way for them to avoid going to a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And they really represent a certain group of people in the organization that does not like change, does not want to do something new, even if the new thing is better. They don't want to change. They just want to keep doing what they're doing the way they know how to do it. They don't learn anything new. And they are your biggest obstacle in any organization in trying to create real change. So one, the change has to be good. It has to be a positive thing for the people that we're trying to enact a change for. If the change is we want everyone to go on a new benefits plan that's half as good and you got to pay twice as much, well, of course they're going to resist, right? And nothing I or anybody else is going to do is make that any better,
mm-hmm.
right? But if the change is good for them, good for the company, good for them, right? Then we have to spend more time with that group, the slow changing group, to help them, because we have our early adopters. If it's a good idea and we explain what we want to do, they'll start doing it, right? I mean, we come up with a silly example. Hey, we're going to stop using this CRM. We're going to use this CRM. And here's all the reasons why it's great, blah, blah, blah. Early adopters will move over quickly.
Yeah.
The people in the middle, they'll come, they'll start to go. But when we get the slow adopters, when we go back and have real conversations with them, we're transparent with them about why we're doing this. We explain to them why it's positive for them. We show them how it's going to benefit them and their job, how it's going to benefit the company, benefit their coworkers. We talk through their fears. We talk through their all of their anxieties and all this stuff. And what I found to be a really great thing to do is to take those people that are the foot flowing crowd, the slow movers, and have them go to lunch or have a meeting or whatever with one of the early adopters by themselves without the manager or someone else of authority or whatever, and say, and of course you tell the early adopter, hey, really want you to go meet with John. He's, you know, kind of struggling with this. Talk to him about what you're seeing, you know, have an open and honest conversation, you know, good, bad, and the ugly, whatever it is. Just go talk to him, answer any of his questions. And you go to John, hey, I really want you to talk to, he's already there. He's already seeing it. Go have a conversation with him, right? I have never had a situation when they came back and the slow adopter was like, well, that's, I'm never changing. It's usually like, okay, I'll give it a shot. They see. And so the early adopters, you want to empower them to get what they need, help them out, let them help you fix all the problems. The people in the middle, I kind of ignore. We're communicating, but we're not really trying to move them. Mm-hmm. But I move the slow adopters, and now they start pushing the whole organization forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they're ready to move. And when the people in the middle go, wait a minute, these guys are already in, they're ready to go. And these guys are ready to go. And I'm sitting in the middle. Oh, geez, I better hurry up. I'm gonna get left behind. And they jump, right? You don't have to worry about them. So that's one way to think about change, is about people. Everything has to start with people. And often organizations screw up the order. It's people and then process. Okay. And so they'll go and they'll pick the process, or they'll pick a tool or the technology. So it's people, process, tools, and technology. They will go and pick technology and tools. They'll come up with a new process, and then they go to their people.
Mm-hmm.
You have screwed it up. You've got to start with people, and then the process has to be right. Then you got to put in the right tools, and then you pick the technology.
Right.
Rarely do companies do it that way. They're like, we're going to Salesforce. We got it. And everyone's like, but that's not good for my job. That's not good for me. Right. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it is, but they don't think that it is. They don't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we got to start with people.
I think you hit it right on the head for that, because the big part for a lot of places that I've worked and the people that I've worked with, the big challenge for them is when the company did it for the cost savings instead of actually for the people. And that seems to be a big problem when they do implement big changes or new systems in place, is because they do it for cost savings and they don't think about the people first. And that is a very great point. And it's funny to think about later on now, you know, in the situations I've been in, if they just want to switch, you know, swap those, what the positive results could have been.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about the 7 pillars. And then I also read that you were a Scrum expert.
I'm a Scrum Master, which Scrum means master. I have a certification in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So do those 7 pillars align with that? And what exactly is Scrum strategy?
Sure. So Scrum is and Agile is also the other word for it. They're synonymous of each other. And Scrum and Agile is a system that was created for software development that has also then bled into the project management realm. So it, inside of my 7 pillars, one of them is systems and measurement. I think every good organization out there seems to have a system that they use. Lean, Six Sigma, mm-hmm. Scrum and Agile, they got something that is the code, it is the verbiage, it is the process that they use to organize and run their business. And no big, great company is just out there floundering, figuring it out one project at a time. They have a methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And methodologies come and go, and they go into vogue or not, but that doesn't really matter. It's just that, do you have a system, and is everyone using it, and are they speaking the same language? And so I think Scrum and Agile is sort of perfect, because if you want to if you're a Fortune 500 and you're doing 1,000 projects and you're super technical and all that, it works great. You're a mom and pop and you got 5 employees and 6 employees, and you want to use the basic tenets of Scrum. You don't have to like learn it and do it to this, you know, nth extent, but you can like take the basic framework and do like a little Scrum meeting. It works really well, right? So it's an easy, great framework to use that essentially is, what are the activities we're trying to get done? And then we meet every day about who's going to get them done. Are we getting them done? What obstacles do we have? And are we putting effort every day towards these special projects, these special activities, right? Hey, we want to get more business over here. Hey, we got to do inventory this month. Hey, we got to, whatever the thing, we got to go to we're moving over to Salesforce. Mm-hmm. Scrum doesn't necessarily run the day-to-day business for most companies. It does if you're creating software, but for everyone else, it's like a project manager. What's the project and can we use the system to run that project? But the point is, you might like Lean and that's your deal. Pick one.
Right.
And use it as a framework to drive results and to give everyone the clear transparency about how do we get things done, right? What's the process so that we can run it and we can be really good at it?
Right. Well, thank you for going more in depth on that. So your book was released on October 31st, The Power of Company Culture, second edition. Can you give the listeners an insight on what the book is about and what are some key differences from the first edition?
Sure. So like I said, the book is really broken into 3 pieces, and we've talked about the middle piece quite a bit, but the first piece is, what do you got to do not to suck? Okay. If you got a company, You're a manager, what's like the bare minimum you got to do not to suck? And there's a lot in there and people are kind of surprised at like, oh, I haven't done that. And I haven't done that. And like, you know, they're trying to be a great culture. They still haven't done some of the basic things.
Yeah.
So that's the first part. What do we got to do? The second part is, what do you have to do if you want to be great? And that's why I give clear examples from organizations, across the globe. And I give the 7 pillars. What's different is I've added additional case studies. So the book is now twice as big. So I've expanded it in every area, in every chapter. I've added more context. I've updated the content to make sure that it's, you know, really relevant to what's happening today. And then we added additional case studies. I went in and worked with Gary Vee's company, VaynerMedia, with his chief heart officer, Claude Silver. And we added an entire case study about what they're doing. I went in and worked with Neiman Marcus, with Eric Severson. And we did a whole case study under the uniqueness chapter on what they're doing around DE&I and how that's very different than, I think, what a lot of other companies are doing or what you might even expect, and how successful they've been. Did a case study with Brady Pyle over at NASA. So we added an entire part. They had a really fascinating story around measurement, about how they really became the place for top employee engagement in all of the government agencies. And we often think about NASA being, oh, well, you know, they got astronauts and it's a cool, sexy place to work. Mm-hmm. And when he started, they were not at the top at all. Right. They were most of their work. They only have 100 astronauts and they're like 18,000 people that work there. So right. Most of other people are doing desk jobs and, you know, doing hard stuff. Work. And, right. The important stuff, but like, it's not sexy. Right.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's like they figured out how to get to the top. And so I added that into there. The third part of the book is, if you want to change, if you read those first two major sections and go, you're right, Chris, we need to change. I've identified these areas, this pillar and that pillar or whatever it is. How the hell do you do it now? You know, it's one thing to know that something's broken. It's one thing to know I need to go get better at this thing, but how do I actually create change? And this was a good part of our earlier part of this conversation, is the actual change management component. Mm-hmm. And that's where I get into some of those real tactical lessons of what are the actual things you need to do so that you can create change, move those people along, help them understand, create more opportunities for communication cadence, transparency. Again, I talked about the slow movers talking to the fast movers, all those like lessons we learned on how do you actually get people to do things much faster and create sticky change, right? Because we've all been through change management where like things change for 10 minutes and then they seem to kind of creep back to the old ways and people stop paying attention.
Right.
I want your changes to be sticky to where they won't come off. They get, you know, it's like getting jam all over you and glitter. It ain't ever coming off.
Yeah.
The change is permanent.
Right. No, that is great. How can the listeners pick up their copies? What's the best way?
If you're in the States, probably Amazon, and most places in the world, it's easy to get on Amazon. If not, I think Bull is another great one around the world, or you can go to the publisher's website, koganpage.com, and feel free to hop on my website if you want to join my newsletter or connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect with anybody who wants to learn more.
Perfect. All right. So I did want to touch on this before we go. I know this is a little away from what we've been talking about throughout, but you're obviously an amazing motivational speaker. You do a lot of keynotes and speak to a lot of different people. So just for the listeners, for leaders of America out there who believe they are ready to make the move to becoming motivational speakers and keynote speakers, what advice would you give them who are just starting out?
Oh, if they would like to become a speaker one day?
Correct.
Yeah, I think you just need to be very clear about what it is that you know or that you're passionate about that you want to talk about. And so, you know, if you're famous, it's a totally different thing, right? If you're, or if your company becomes famous or somehow you get tons of PR for something, you can kind of fast forward this process. But otherwise, for everybody else, this is how I started. Figure out what it is you want to talk about. What is you're passionate about? What is it you can really help people with? And figure out who it is that might want to actually listen to that. Who might you be able to help? And go and volunteer to speak wherever it is you can go and speak. I mean, I spoke to 6 people at the back of a Radisson on a Tuesday at 11:30. That's where I started.
Yeah.
You know, and you one group at a time, you work on your craft, you get better at speaking, you realize what resonates with people, what doesn't. People start asking questions and you go, oh, that's interesting. I have a total solution for that. And you realize that's my keynote, not the thing I started with. So it's just kind of a process of starting, working hard, continuing to iterate that message, get out there and speak as much as you can. And then at some point you'll get enough traction that snowball will get some momentum. And then you can decide if you're going to start charging, you're going to start submitting to conferences and all of that. And that's kind of the next level up.
Oh, thank you for this, Chris. This has been amazing. Thank you for joining the show. I really appreciate it. And, you know, good luck with your book and good luck with everything else. And thank you for sharing all this insight with all the listeners and myself.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.